Hi, this is Dr. John Klein from the University of Guelph, the Simcoe Research Station in Simcoe, Ontario, in Canada.
Hi, this is Derek Plakowski from the University of Guelph in Guelph, Ontario, Canada, and you are listening to Cider Chat.
And you're listening to Cider Chat.
And this is episode 45. Hello and welcome to Cider Chat. My name is Aria Wincaller and I am your Cider MC. On this weekly podcast where we go out into Ciderville and speak to cider makers, cider enthusiasts, and folks within the cider trade. And who are those folks? Well, they're people just like our guest on today's show who are researchers in pomology. Very interesting, right? I hope that's already perking up your ears a little bit and they're starting to flap and saying, pomology, dang, that's all about the apple. We'll be speaking to these two gentlemen who are based in Canada at the University of Guelph, and this is in Ontario. There's going to be a lot in this podcast. We'll be speaking about what it takes to become a pomologist, what's going on with the cider apple research, specifically to their project, and also a bit about nitrogen in cider making and a rather interesting discussion on terroir. A lot in that chat. That'll be coming up in a moment. Well, there's been a lot going on in my spot of Ciderville. I imagine the same is true for you. We're in the month of September, and that's a time when the kids are back in school, folks are back in college, and things are just starting to rock and roll if it's fall in your territory. And if you're in the southern hemisphere and going into winter, well, you're full on in checking your cider. And for me, I like to catch you up. Next week, I'll be talking about Cider Days, the event that happens in New England. It is considered one of the oldest cider events in the world, and I'll be going through some tips on that amazing fest. And then tonight, I'm going to be recording a chat with Marie from Tokyo. She'll be talking about the cider scene in Japan and the recent Tokyo Cider Fest. Really, really excited about that, to find out what's happening on that side of the world. And that podcast should go live so in about 2 weeks while I am away traveling in Europe. Now that sounds all groovy. I want to say that I'm going there specifically to work at a psychiatric center, which is something that I've been doing for many, many years. I write curriculum on crisis intervention, and I was honored to be selected by this organization there. It's a mental health organization, and it borders the territory of Belgium. I'll talk more about that trip as I'm going along, but that trip I decided to extend because I was already over there, and so I took a few more days and kind of squeezed it in to head down to Normandy, and you probably have been hearing me speak about this if you are a regular listener to Cider Chat. On that trip, I squeezed in a chat with the president of the Appellation of Control for Cider, Calvados, and Palmet. And then we'll also be speaking to Eric Bordelais, who is a renowned cider maker in that region. Then I was scheduled to fly out of Paris and head home. It seemed pretty tight, I was able to fit it in and kind of squeeze a little bit more out of the pocket to make that trip. Then, lo and behold, Ciderville, an invitation came from La Cidra, and that was an invitation to attend the 6th Annual International Hall of Gala Ciders. Now, I didn't know much about this because, to tell you the truth, it's a little hard to find out about Cidra. Like only so much you could kind of find out about the cider route in Normandy, never mind going down to Spain. And I was scratching my head. Anzu, who is the editor for La Cidra, was very, very helpful. And I also reached out to Andreas Sugrin, who was on our chat, if you recall. He is the Swedish cider maker of ice cider, that is the Brånlund ice cider. in Sweden, and he attended last year, and his ice cider won a gold medal. And what Andreas said was that it is the new, upcoming, and most serious competition in Europe, and really recommended that I attend. Well, I'm trying to. I have to let Anzu know by the end of this week, because there's only so much space that they could kind of get folks into hotels. And there's a piece where, okay, great, I'm already in Europe, that sounds good, but now I have to change my flight, I have to get a flight down from Paris and kind of manage extending my stay even further. And that sounds really good, but this is becoming an expensive hobby for me. So I'm reaching out to you, Ciderville, to help me get there so we could get some good inside scoop on this region. You know, the sidra where it's pouring from a meter high. I mean, really, if you don't know what I'm talking about, raise your arm above your head and imagine that you're holding a bottle of cider and now pouring it into a glass that you're holding below your waist. That's what they do there. But truthfully, it's very difficult to find out what's happening in the region, especially if you're English speaking. And that's what I'm going to try to do. I'm not sure if I could swing it, though, without your support. So if you could lend me a hand, please go to ciderchat.com. There's a donate button there. And also look to the Cider Chat Patreon page. Both of those are great tools for contributing and having some support for this as we reach out around the world. And fingers crossed I can make it so, because it is like ticking and it came out of kind of like the blue for me. And now it's like, woo, let's see if we can make it happen. I think it would not be something that I would regret, of course. And certainly I want to bring you along virtually as much as I can. Oh boy, oh joy, so much good stuff going on. Which leads me now to our chat this week with Dr. John Klein and Derek Plakowski. Derek wrote to me a while back, and I read his email on Cider Chat, and he was telling us then how he had found out about this podcast and was listening to it on his long drive, about an hour and a half back and forth to the research station, which I thought was so interesting. And then that led me to finding out a little bit more about what he was doing. And I thought, bingo, this is something that Ciderville should hear about. And don't you know, this is what we're going to be listening to now. And I just want to say, I just feel so happy when I hear and get to meet good people doing this type of work for Ciderville and really moving research on the cider apple forward. And at the end of this podcast, you'll hear a little tidbit that Dr. John Klein wanted to also do a tip of the hat to other researchers in North America. But it's really, really a great benefit for all of us. So without further ado, how's about if you and I grab a glass and join this chat and head to Ontario, Canada, with John Klein and Derek Plakowski at the University of Guelph. I've been really excited to speak to you both, and I know that Ciderville is too, because it all begins with the apple, and now we have experts in pomology. So why don't we start there and talk about what exactly that means to be a pomologist. Maybe Dr. Klein, you would like to begin.
Pomology, in my instance, is the study of tree fruits, but it embraces the study of fruits in general. From a horticultural point of view, a pomologist would study how the fruit tree grows, different cultivars, training systems. And in our research interests, we're really interested in providing information to growers so they can improve their practices in growing production.
When you're doing that for growers, I mean, what are the specific areas that you're looking at to help them improve? Is it looking at the soil? Is it looking at the specific trees? Where do you begin there?
We study a number of aspects, what we call orchard management or cultural management of tree fruits. Because there are many different things we could study, we often go to the growers and ask them, you know, what are the key issues in in some cases, problems that you're facing, and how can we help you? And the things that are of most interest, it seems, to growers at the moment is things such as fruit quality, how to improve the fruit we grow to make it more marketable and more appealing to consumers. Economics always play a role. How can we produce the fruit in a more sustainable and profitable way for both the grower and for other people in the distribution chain? Our work encompasses irrigation, soil management, how to reduce the number of apples on the tree so that those that remain on the tree size up and grow to a commercial standard size. Other aspects include testing new varieties that we don't know a lot of information about, but they've caught on in the marketplace, and there's always differences, either large or small, that growers need to know about to maximize the quality and production of these new varieties. So those are some aspects that we deal with in terms of pomology.
And Dr. Klein, how did you get into pomology, and how long have you been in this particular field?
My interest started a long time ago. My father was a research scientist with the local Ontario government. We had a small hobby fruit farm where I grew up, and I had a interest in the fruit growing. We lived in Niagara Peninsula, which is quite a unique growing area. It's the Niagara Peninsula's southern part of Lake Ontario, between really the state of New York, and it borders the New York State, and it's in a region that is close to Niagara Falls is in the Niagara Peninsula. And it's a very unique growing area. It's quite warmer than most of Canada, where we can grow peaches and grapes and cherries and apples and many other crops. And that, because of my parental interest, that's really how I got interested in pomology and studied it after that point in university.
And how long ago did you start getting into pomology full-time to the degree now? You're a professor, is that correct?
Yes. I started my career in the mid-1990s. I went to school at Michigan State and then overseas in England. After completing those degrees, I came to Ontario and have been in this position since the mid-1990s, studying various aspects of the pomology. With initially it was the Ontario government, now with the University of Guelph.
And you specifically look at the apple, or are you looking at other palms? Is that what you say? Is that the correct way to say it, palms?
Apples are palm fruit, but I also look at cherries and peaches, which are, we consider those stone fruits. Mm-hmm. Those are the three crops that I work on, but predominantly it's apples because of probably a larger industry in that area, locally in Ontario.
Mm-hmm. Are there conferences for pomologists? Is that like a big gathering where folks get out in the orchard or go to a conference center and you know, like we do for like a cider fest? Are there events like that for pomologists?
There are. They're not really called specifically pomology conferences, but they're. I meet with a number of colleagues, many of whom are from the United States, through various horticultural groups. One of the predominant groups we meet with is a group called the NC140, which is a USDA technical group who really studies rootstocks for tree fruits. So most of those people are pomologists by training or with background. And so that would be one venue where we would get together. Others are with the American Society of Hort Science, Canadian Society of Sport Science. And we're a small group, but there are a number of us that do get together annually at scientific meetings and grower conferences. Another very popular grower conference is called the International Fruit Tree Association, which includes a lot of the growers as well as the scientists.
Mm-hmm. And if somebody was interested in a career in this field, is there like a certain undergraduate study that they would begin with and then go into like a graduate course for development into this particular area?
Yes, there are various programs. Really, in Canada, there's not very many. There's at University of Guelph has a horticultural program through our plant agriculture department, where you could take one or two courses in pomology. Most of the advanced training would come through a graduate degree at the master's or PhD level, which Derek has joined me on doing a PhD in pomology. There are a lot of great schools in the U.S. at Cornell, Michigan State, UC Davis, to name a few. There's many others, but those are some of the more popular ones that come to mind.
Mm-hmm. Now, we connected because of Derek and his listening to Cider Chat and connecting with myself. And I wonder, from your perspective over the past, I'm going to say 5 years, and maybe it was further back, but have you seen any uptick in interest in your field based upon the recent resurgence of cider in North America?
Yes, definitely. Although, you know, my interest probably started about 5 years ago, there's scientists who have been looking at this for a number of years in North America. Ian Merwin at Cornell University is one individual, a colleague whose name comes to mind. He really was working on this more than a decade ago, probably a couple decades ago, and really leading the path in terms of research, much, I think, before it became as popular it is. My interest really began 5 years ago when it was pretty clear that there was a renewed interest in Ontario here in cider, and the cider industry was really looking for access to new varieties, new cultivars that would help them produce a premium product. And that's probably when I got involved and how I got involved with the cider industry.
Mm-hmm. Are you a cider drinker at all?
I can't confess to be a large cider drinker. I'm fairly new at it and new at learning about the different ciders. I do enjoy a glass here and there, but it's not something I've had a large opportunity to explore yet. But I look forward to that, and I know Derek is very versed in different ciders, and I hope to learn a lot from him during his time here at the University of Guelph.
Right. Well, we'll take every cider drinker we can get, so I'm glad that you enjoy at least an occasional glass. And Derek, your interest is in pomology. What are you specifically looking at in your studies?
So we're looking at a few different things right now. I wouldn't say I'm new to pomology, but my background, I come from a more general botany background. And then during my master's, a bit more of viticulture and enology, so wine and grape studies, along with some terroir management and business. So I'm sort of new to pomology, although I've known I've wanted to do apple work for a long time. In the research that we're doing, we're actually doing cultivar trials. That's one of the reasons that John brought me on as a graduate student, was to do this study with the Ontario Craft Cider Association and the Ministry of Agriculture here, where we're actually doing site tests at 5 sites across the province for roughly 30 apple cultivars. And I'm also, that project was started about a year ago, and of course it's going to take several years before those trees that were just planted are going to be producing regular fruit. So I'm really hoping to be done with my doctorate by the time that those are ready. So we're working on a few other things related to nutrition and nitrogen in juice, actually, for the apples, for my actual thesis, although that's still, I still haven't presented an official proposal yet, so there's still a little bit of time for that to be altered. Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what it means to call something a cultivar? What does that mean?
Yeah. So cultivar is a cultivated variety. So a cultivar of an apple would be any of the varieties that you're able to point out, whether it is Fuji or Yarlington Mill or Crimson Crisp or Gala. Those are all cultivars. Much like you would say the same thing with grape varieties, there, you could say cultivars of grapes would be Cabernet Sauvignon or Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, something that kind of piqued my ears up here that you're talking about in terms of the nitrogen, because that's an important factor in with apples and certainly with cider making. Can you speak more about what you're looking at specifically there?
Sure, I can talk a little bit. So one of the things I've noticed in reading the literature is that there does not seem to be any consistent sort of recommendation for the amount of nitrogen that's actually available to the yeast. It's called yeast assimilable nitrogen. There's no consistent recommendation for where that should be in juices in order to allow for a complete fermentation, as in a fermentation complete to dryness. A lot of it depends on the actual yeast strain that you're using, but you have some of the literature, such as some of the papers that have been published, saying all of the apples, cider apples, have very low amounts of nitrogen and you need to supplement. And then you have other people like Claude Jolicoeur from the New Cider Maker's Handbook saying there's way too much nitrogen and we need to try and find as little nitrogen as possible. So you have this sort of dissonance in people recommending nitrogen. So I'd really like to see if we can find, make a good recommendation for cider making. And in addition to that, I'd like to see how we can manipulate this amount of nitrogen in the apples in the orchard, whether it be by cultural practices or fertilization practices. I just want to see how we can change it, and if there are certain cultivars that, which there are certain cultivars that have lower or higher yeast assimilable nitrogen in their juice. So it's really about finding as much as we can about it so that we can change this in the orchard, whether or not we're going to have more nitrogen or less. The nice thing about the research is it's not necessarily going to be about going in one direction of boosting the nitrogen or decreasing it. It's, if we know enough, we could do either.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to kind of maybe sound like kind of like a dumb bunny in the scientific world, but in terms of nitrogen, I see that as a gas. So
we're not talking about nitrogen gas here, actually. Nitrogen, of course, is an element, and it can be form part of lots of compounds. It can be in nitrates, which are often parts of different kinds of salts. They can be in, they're one of the most important parts of amino acids, and amino acids are what make up proteins. It's also a part of ammonium or ammonia, and it's one of the most common elements found in life in general, in all of biology. So we're not actually talking about nitrogen gas at all. When you're talking nitrogen gas and cider, you're talking about inert gases used in the cider making process, and that's important. But we're talking about nutrients actually for the yeast. One of the ways that I like to think of cider making is, and this might have been actually from, somebody might have mentioned something similar in one of your chats before, is that a cider maker is taking care of the juice as a medium for yeast when the yeast are doing the transformations, and a cider maker is taking care of that. And the yeast as an organism needs nutrition, needs to be taken care of, and a large part of that is nitrogen. But the yeast can only eat certain types of compounds that have nitrogen in them. So some things like basic amino acids are mostly all right, besides a few of them. Whereas something that's more complex, like a protein, the yeast isn't going to be able to use.
Well, I really appreciate you kind of exploring that with me, because I think that this is, you know, we throw these terms out and we kind of assume everybody knows what we're talking about there. And specifically in terms of cider making, a lot of folks are really looking for that low nutrient apple. And and they're also looking for apple trees that have been around for a while, because, you know, and I'm kind of curious how you both see that too. What's the difference there? And can you explain that to like the layperson like myself? What's the difference between a younger apple and an older apple? Is it the root? Does it begin with an apple tree, I should say? Does it begin with the rootstock or the soil? What's impacting it?
I'm going to let John take that one.
Would you mind rephrasing your question? I'm not sure I quite understand.
Sure. When we hear about, well, cider makers in particular are often looking for like a low nutrient apple to lend the type of cider making they're doing. So what would impact that particular tree? You know, a lot of folks, you know, you have your flowers, you plant it, you want to like give it a lot of fertilizer. But with apple trees, I find that folks aren't necessarily doing that, that they're maybe looking for a soil compound that isn't going to be as fertile as you would for like your tomato plants or other garden vegetables. Can you speak anything to that in terms of the nutrients in the apple tree itself? Is that coming based off of the soil, or is that in relationship to the root stock that you begin with? Or three, is that also dependent upon the age of the apple tree?
The primary factor in nutrition in the orchard is initially when we plant the tree, we're interested in growing the tree, establishing it in the first 1 or 2 years. And here I'm speaking primarily from a high-density orchard that's using a variety for fresh market. I don't have a lot of experience yet with the cider varieties and their need for nitrogen, but nevertheless, I imagine it would follow a similar type of methodology. Through research, there are criteria that are used to establish minimum levels of nutrients, including nitrogen. And we don't look at the soil for that. We actually look at the plant, and we take leaf samples and analyze them for nitrogen in mid-July every year, or when we want to assess the nitrogen concentration in the plant. And for example, a range of about 2.2% nitrogen on a dry matter basis of the leaf is the target. And if we were to find that to be low, we would either apply a foliar nitrogen that year or wait till the following spring and apply a broadcast fertilizer to the ground, most likely, and to boost the nitrogen. In many cases, extra nitrogen is not needed in our soils in Ontario. And so a lot of growers don't necessarily add a lot of additional nitrogen. There's already sufficient amounts in the soil. But in high-density orchards, we might add extra just to get the tree growing the first 1 or 2 years. And then we would expect it to fruit after about 2 years. And this is using a dwarfing rootstock. In terms of the rootstock and age, generally they don't play as big a role. Generally, the larger the older the tree gets, the larger it gets, and we would add more nitrogen accordingly. But that would be adjusted again based on leaf levels of nitrogen that are analyzed in the orchard.
So the actual age of the tree doesn't necessarily have an impact on the fruit. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not really what I meant. Young trees generally produce poorer quality fruit. And by young, I mean in the year 2, 3, and 4. The fruit tend to be softer. They don't store as well, and hence they're not as desirable. And if in case of apples, if you have too much nitrogen, then that adds to poor quality. So we would definitely not want additional or extra nitrogen that can make the fruit soft, immature, and it can actually make the tree less hardy for the winter, make it more susceptible to injury from winter cold temperatures.
So am I understanding this correctly, that around year 3, the change there for the apple tree, you're going for that more hardy fruit, more choice fruit perhaps. Is that due to the nitrogen, or is there something that happens around year 3 with the tree?
I don't think it's attributed just to nitrogen. Mm-hmm. The main factor, I think, would be the tree is producing more fruit. And when you get a higher, what we call a crop load or a number of fruit on the tree, you get more uniform consistency and quality and size. Generally, large fruit are poorer quality. And so when you have a light cropping tree in years, say year 2 or 3, the quality is more inconsistent. But when it gets into more stable production with more fruit per tree and uniform size, that's when we get into better quality fruit, more consistent quality, not just because of nitrogen, but more generally from other cultural management practices.
Yeah, because that's always an interesting area to talk to folks about, because many orchardists are quite proud of their older trees. You know, some could be over 100 years old. And if you go over to Europe, maybe even older than that, and folks are, you know, really consider those are like the choice trees, both the apple tree and the pear trees. Is that your experience too? Do you study many really old trees at the university there, or out in the field at different plots?
Generally, no. Our orchards are really mature after year 6, 5, 6, 7 years, depending on the variety in the rootstock. And they would be grown for about 20, 25 years, and then either the variety is no longer of interest, or the production might fall, or the quality might fall, and so growers would maybe replant. However, there are a lot of older trees that are well over 30, 40 years here that are growing terrific quality fruit. A lot of that has to do with pruning and light interception. For the fresh market, we want apples that are sufficient size, you know, minimum 2.5 inches, with lots of color for the commercial, for the retail market. And provided the canopy is open and well pruned, that can be quite easily achieved with an older tree. Mm-hmm. But more difficult with the newer orchards and the way they're grown, using these much higher density and open training systems, the light interception is much more uniform and easier to get into the middle of the tree, and therefore the quality tends to be a little bit better compared with the older trees. But of course, this may not be as much of an issue with cider varieties, where you know, fruit color is not necessarily important. It's the flavor profiles and the juice from the fruit that are more important.
That's true. You know, there is this bumper sticker that I have now that says, you know, ugly apples taste better. That's a little bit of the cider mode of it all. well, you know, I find this so fascinating. And I'm sure, you know, out in Ciderville right now listening, they're just kind of churning all these kind of questions, and probably they'll come flooding in after this gets posted. But just kind of continuing along with this, you know, I wonder, in terms of Canada, is the government like full on supporting like apple production? Is it a major crop, I guess I would say, for Canada?
Yes, Canada, in terms of fruit crops, apples are I think, second to blueberries in terms of fruit crops. In terms of tree fruit, they're number one. Our growing areas are quite relatively small because of our climate, but we have major growing areas in the Okanagan Valley in British Columbia, southern Ontario, and Quebec, towards the Montreal, southern part of Quebec, a little bit in New Brunswick, PEI, a little bit in Nova Scotia is probably the third most productive regions in the province. In terms of the area of Canada is quite small, but the government is quite supportive of tree fruit growers and apple growers in general. An example is just through the support we receive quite a bit of federal and provincial funding in our research programs, and the fact there is a research program in tree fruit is indicative of the government's support.
Absolutely. Now, you are doing some research now, and I'm not sure how much you could talk about it. Is that particular to cider apples currently that you're doing some research on? Is there anything that you could lend us opening on what you're doing there?
Sure, I'd love to share that. Derek alluded to it in his earlier comments. Probably 4 years ago, I met with the Ontario Craft Cider Association, a newly formed group representing cider makers. And it was clear one of the messages that they were sending to me was that they wanted access to some of the cider varieties, of which really there's not enough of grown in Ontario, or even some of them don't exist. So our initial approach was to acquire material to create nursery trees to then generate the orchards. So our first efforts were to, in the propagation area, we had 30 different varieties propagated by a commercial nursery. Finding those varieties was actually a very big challenge because many of them aren't virus indexed, and that means they can't cross our borders into Canada. And so we had to source them all locally. And we ended up with 30 varieties. We wanted to have others, but we just couldn't get access to them. And that's another something I could talk about that would take more time. But eventually we got the trees growing, and we planted them last year in a multi-site location, including the University of Guelph Simcoe. And really we have... most of them are actual cider varieties. A couple of them are fresh market varieties, but most of them are the cider varieties well known to your listeners. And our goal is to really look at the horticultural aspects of growing these. How productive are they? What are the growing issues? How do they perform on dwarfing rootstocks such as M9? What are their disease and insect susceptibilities? How prone are they to winter injury? We have some very cold temperatures in some of these regions that reach minus 35, and we're expecting some of them not to survive. So we'd like to learn that information so we can share that and all the production information with with our growers, so they can be better informed of what varieties to plant and how well they might perform in terms of making cider locally.
And when do you expect to have some findings available for the Ontario Cider Association or the Crafts Cider Association or the general public?
It will take a few years. We were gathering information already about tree growth, flowering data. Derek was involved in looking at the flowering dates, and that's quite interesting because they flower at different times, but generally later. But the real production information will come starting probably next year, and that would be year three. And year three, four, five would sort of give us some preliminary information on yield, fruit size, and some aspects of how well the trees are cropping, producing, and surviving. So it will take a few years, but it won't be too far out, we hope, before we get some answers.
Well, I'm sure everybody's just sitting on their apple baskets just waiting for any little tidbits you could throw them. You know, I know a lot of folks have been to Canada, but for anyone who hasn't, when you travel over the border from the U.S. into Canada, you just start seeing cider signs everywhere. And that's something I remember when I was, you know, a young person, you know, a wee lass, I would say. And so it has this very long tradition of cider. And then it seemed, well, for probably different reasons, like here in the U.S., kind of strayed away a little bit. But it was really the birthing place of ice cider making too in Quebec. So I wonder, as you're getting into this research, it's my understanding that in Canada, is it true that you're really one of the only sites there doing cider apple research at this point?
To my knowledge, that is true in terms of horticulture.
There were some papers published from Summerland a few years ago that I came across in my research there out in BC, but I don't know if they're doing anything currently.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with a lot of current information or projects in that area. Quebec is no doubt doing some work, and Derek would be more familiar with that than, in fact, I would be, but... I think there's renewed interest, but we're really just getting into it, and I don't think too many others are at this point in Canada.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm so excited about the work that you are doing. And Derek, I'm wondering, as you're getting deeper into this research and your understanding of the apple itself and pomology in general, how has it impacted your cider making or cider quaffing, I could say, too? Has it?
Yeah, that's a complicated question. I mean, it's actually been a while since I've made cider on my own. I'm going to hopefully do some more this year. Like I said to you before, I was traveling the last few years during my master's degree from place to place in Europe, so I didn't really have the chance to, I couldn't bring my carboy with me and make some cider on the go. So, I was really just, I haven't actually made cider in a while, on my own. But I would definitely say that, learning more about the different, apple varieties and the different regions of apple production and the different climates and traditions has changed the way I look at cider. I also have a wine background, like I said. In my master's degree, one of the official modules that we had was terroir management. We were actually understanding and learning about this concept of terroir and what it meant to wine. It equally applies to cider, of course. And once you begin to learn about a place, then you can begin to understand the products that come from it. I know that's sort of getting off topic, but it's really integral to my understanding of cider as a terroir product, as a craft beverage. Used to like to say about wine, and it's equally true for cider, that it's like geography in a bottle, because you are really taking everything about a place and distilling it into one product there. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And that was a bit off topic, but
not at all.
I was hoping
no.
You're getting what I'm saying.
Oh yeah, I think that's a great place to talk about is a terroir, because that really, when you had mentioned that, the terroir management, I thought, well, what does that actually mean to be studying terroir management?
I still ask myself that question. even though I technically have a master's degree in it, I'm usually not entirely sure exactly what it means. Partly was because that module was in French, and that was just really difficult. But it's... I do have a definition right here in front of me that was really important to us. It's from the OIV, which is the International Organization of Wine and Vine. Their definition, if you allow me, vitivinicultural terroir is a concept which refers to an area in which collective knowledge of the interactions between the identifiable physical and biological environment and applied grape growing and winemaking practices develops, providing distinctive characteristics for the products originating from this area. Terroir includes specific soil, topography, climate, landscape, characteristics, and biodiversity features. And that's a definition taken directly from their website. And so it just sort of enumerates lots of different parts of it. I remember doing a project during this master's program about Perry. We were in a region that, when I was living in France there, we were in a region that produced some Perry. We were in a department called Maine-et-Loire, and which is where the city of Angers is located. And there's some cider in that area, but it's more pears. It's the Anjou region, so you might be familiar with Anjou pears. Mm-hmm. And I was doing a project about Perry, and I think I had to do an advertisement or something. And I said, you know, this is a product that contains, you know, the sun and the soil and the water from our area. And a classmate of mine said, there's already a French word for this. It's terroir. And I was thinking, oh, I guess you're right. It's all of these things together.
I wonder then, in where you are in Canada, what's the terroir there that you're noticing of for the apples? And you could also speak on pears too, of course. But, you know, and I kind of want to just say my own hit, what I see a lot regionally is a difference in acidity in the apples. But maybe it's different. Maybe I'm going the wrong track.
I haven't had, I mean, I've had quite a few Ontario ciders, but I haven't had enough to really pick up on a distinctive terroir. And one of the things about the idea is that it is related to a very specific place. So once you start expanding beyond the size of even a single orchard, it becomes more and more difficult to call something a terroir product. Even if something is made from all Ontario apples, it's hard to really say that it's an Ontario terroir because it might come from completely different regions with completely different climates and soils. When you're talking terroir, you're talking about a very specific spot. And most of the ciders that I've had here still come from lots of different places around the province, even if it's all Ontario apples. Terroir ciders that I've had, you know, where you're coming from very specific sites, those I've had either in Europe or actually in the Finger Lakes in New York, where the producers are very terroir-minded.
Well, I think that is a factor in cider because there could be a lot of imported juice and just imported from within the country,
right,
from different provinces or across state lines as here in
right,
the U.S. So that does change that profile, no doubt.
Talking about terroir with producers and with lots of people, it's difficult just because it's, although there is this very precise definition put forward by the OIV, it can be very difficult to put your finger on where terroir begins and where it ends, and where locality begins and ends. It can be quite difficult to label whether or not something is a terroir product or not. And so it's something that I personally, even though I have this background in studying it, I'm always a little bit wary talking about terroir with producers because it's something that a lot of people want, but a lot of people don't quite understand and don't quite know how to do it. And it's one of those things where I think a lot of people are saying, oh, yeah, this is a terroir product. This is something we're trying to strive for, and don't really know what it is that they're trying to say. you know, it has a very specific meaning, and it's really important to understand. It's a really wonderful concept, but it can be very oblique, very difficult to really say, this is what it is, and say, I have it or I don't in my cider, or my cider has it or it doesn't.
Well,
I don't know.
Well, the chat that's on this week with Sebastian LeCider from Flag Hill in Vermont, he makes all his cider from just locally sourced apples, whether they're on his property or just sourcing it from that town. And it's also organic certified cider too, which is kind of unique. But what I think is really interesting there, when you taste that cider, you're believing in something too. That terroir makes you believe that you're tasting something so pinpointed, you know, in that region. I believe you can taste it, and I think
that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And the idea is that you're tasting that region. It goes back to that geography in a bottle thing. If you're, there should be something about it that is able to make you say, yes, this is from this part of Vermont, or this is from, oh yeah, this is definitely made from the Finger Lakes. I can tell because of these characteristics. That's definitely the case. That's what it is with wine too. Mm-hmm. You should be able to say there are distinctive things that help you say, this is where it's from. This is where this wine is from. This is where this cider is from. And there can be similarities, of course, between ciders from completely different regions. They might have a pretty similar terroir, depending on the soil and climate of that specific region. Absolutely. There is definitely this idea of you should be able to tell where it's from, but when you start mixing things from lots of different places, all that becomes obscured. Mm-hmm. And it's not to say that those products aren't good products. That's not to say that at all. But you start being able to lose that local color, I suppose, if that's how you want to think of it.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good topic that I really enjoy chatting about, because there's so much there. And I know the more that you're talking about, Derek, the more that you sound like you really know what terroir is. So give yourself a little bit of credit there.
Okay, well, I certainly don't feel like it, but sure.
Well, you know, we call that cider bold, so go for it. I was wondering, with the apple trees themselves, one of the things that I sometimes hear over and over again, and again, this chat this week with Sebastian, he was originally from the UK. One thing that he says, and others have said, is that North America is just so darn good for growing apples. Is that what both of you would agree with? I don't know if you've kind of studied outside of North America. Certainly you have, Derek, but perhaps Dr. Klein, you have too. What can you say about the ability to grow apples in North America in terms of other regions? Is there like a uniqueness to it or not? Maybe we're just kind of wishful thinking.
I can try to handle that one first. I think the United States is very very proficient and advanced in their ability to grow apples, and they have some great regions, some of which are quite different. If you take the Washington state of Washington, it's an irrigated agricultural setting, and it's known for being very productive, and mainly because of high light interception, very few cloudy days, and it's on par with New Zealand. Is probably the one of the best, very best growing regions in the world. In terms of productivity, but equally you have the eastern areas, Massachusetts, Vermont, Pennsylvania, New York, Michigan. These are also very, very productive areas, I would think they're on par with being the most productive in the world. They have the good soils, good climate, and growers with great horticultural ability, and with the new training systems, they can really get very high yields from the ways they're growing trees now, maximizing light interception, using irrigation, the best varieties. You know, when you combine all these things, it adds up to being a very successful venture.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's different ways to farm apples. I mean, there's a more kind of mass-produced type of apple kind of production. Then there's the organic style. Then there's biodynamic farming and integrated pest management. Is there one particular way that you're looking at in your study here? Is it like a standard type of farming for apples, or do you branch off in any directions there?
In terms of a research, we generally use more conventional integrated pest management methods for growing. Mm-hmm. However, we're fortunate actually with our cider project, where we have four commercial growers, where we have these sites. There is one in particular who's organically certified, and he's growing these 30 varieties in that setting, and we're very pleased about that, because we will be able to test the susceptibility of these varieties to disease and insects that are probably more challenging to control in that setting, and may be easier to see in that setting than otherwise when conventional sprays are used. So we're fortunate in our project to both have conventional IPM type orchards and organic, and both are important to our growers and our consumers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And for this coming year of 2016, what is the harvest, you know, for apples looking like? Because it was kind of an odd winter in North America. Was there a big impact, as like 2015, there was just a huge boom of apples everywhere? But I'm wondering what you're seeing this year in your region.
I'll speak for the Ontario region, not so much the western and eastern provinces, but our area came off of a fairly light year last year because of some frost damage. So the crop, we entered the season in May with very wonderful bloom, lots of bloom on the trees, and very good pollination conditions. And we had very warm, sunny days throughout, actually right from bloom until now. The one challenge, big challenge, has been a wide drought throughout the province. Mm-hmm. We've had much lower than normal rainfall. And if growers don't have supplemental irrigation, they'll be faced with challenges of getting fruit size, the fruit that are large enough to reach the minimum of usually 2.5 inches or larger, or a 163 count size apple. But if we have the irrigation, it's looking like a very good crop. Mm-hmm. At the research station and in the commercial orchards.
So apples aren't like grapes in that if it's really, really dry, you have a higher sugar content, which might be choice for a cider maker, or is it?
Yes, they'll certainly, if you have the sunlight and the dry conditions, you can have a better quality product. But I don't think they're as well known to respond to the drought as, say, a grape would be. But I know that, you know, the peach growers in the area were quite pleased about the peach harvest because it was dry and sunny, and the flavor was apparently better than other years. So I think there's some truth to what you're saying there.
I'd like to thank Dr. John Klein and Derek Plakowski, both from the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada. And good luck to you both on that cider apple research. I'm sure we'll be checking back in again as that research rolls out into the coming year. And how cool was that, just talking about terroir? There's a great quote that Derek said. I want to repeat it again. he really summed it up about the terroir piece, which is when you're talking about terroir, you're talking about a very specific spot, or you could say location. That's kind of the short answer to what terroir is. I thought that was fantastic. And how cool is it to find out that they test nitrogen by taking samples of a dry leaf from an apple tree, for instance. Lots of stuff in this chat. And going back to what I said earlier, I'll be putting a link in there to the Ontario Craft Cider Association. This is episode 45, and I'll also be putting a link where you could check out La Cidra, which I mentioned earlier. That is a magazine that I think has been out for 15 years. There you could find out more about Cidra, and it's a great read, so I really encourage you to subscribe to that magazine. And in the meantime, please do support my quest to get to the International Hall of Gala Ciders just at the end of this September into October. It's very time sensitive, so please contribute today to Cider Chat. You can find that donation button or Cider Chat's Patreon page at ciderchat.com. I'm going to now get ready for my chat with Marie in Tokyo. I really appreciate your time today and look forward to speaking with you next week as we explore all there is about Cider Days in New England this coming November. This is Rhea Windcaller signing off for now. Looking forward to seeing you in Ciderville.
I'd like just to acknowledge the great work that's been done at Washington State University on the cider work and Cornell University through various researchers and programs there. We certainly want to acknowledge their work and give credit to them because we look at that information too quite closely.